You cannot lose games in the NFL and still win.
One day I understand. One day, go see the baby be born and come back. You're a Major League Baseball player.
Did I not tell you?
Yes, you did.
See, don't answer. These are rhetorical questions because you know I told you and you know I'm not.
Analytics don't work at all. They're just a crap to some people who were really smart, made up to try to get in the game because they had no talent.
This kid is a gamer. He's a follower. He's a playmaker and a shot caller.
In case you didn't know,
I got T-Bowed. He shattered the mold. And all he does is win. All he does is win.
Hello and welcome to Hot Takedown, 538 Sports Podcast. I'm Chadwick Matlin, an editor at 538, and today I am all alone in the studio. I'm looking at the chairs that my co-hosts usually sit in, and it's lonely here. Kate's somewhere, I think, in Greece. Neil's somewhere in Japan. And I'm tied to my desk domestically. And so, rather than try and replace those two irreplaceable co-hosts, we have decided to do something a little different this week in the dog days of summer. We are going to do a compilation show of two old stat schools. And for new listeners, stat schools are when we lean on Neil the Stat Man's expertise in sports and in strategy and in how advanced statistics work. And he basically guides us through levels of complexity, ascending levels of complexity in a given sport. So we're going to play two football stat schools for you today, both of which are primed to get you ready for the NFL season and to talk more, you know, more empirically about the NFL as they crash their heads against one another all season long. The first is going to be about passing and passing statistics and metrics and what to believe and what not to believe. And then the second is going to be about rushing. Long-time Hot Takedown listeners will recognize these. I doubt you've retained all the information, given that I have not retained all the information in them, so they are worth a re-listen despite that. And then next week, hopefully the full crew will be back, airlines depending. Before we get into this week's show, though, an announcement, a little business to take care of what will be soon appearing in your Hot Takedown podcast feed. I'm sitting here in the studio with Hot Takedowns. What's your current title in Hot Takedown land? Is it senior global domestic tennis correspondent?
Global and extraterrestrial and
you've gone galactic.
Underwater, yep.
Love it.
Any form.
That's Carl Bialik's voice. You hear, you will recognize his voice from various tennis segments on Hot Takedown. And Carl, you have a small announcement of some more tennis things coming into the Hot Takedown feed.
Yeah, last year at this time during the U.S. Open, we recorded some special episodes on the grounds in Flushing, and we called it Baseline. And it was a little taste of what's happening during the tournament.
This is the U.S. Open.
Yes. Of course, all of our listeners knew exactly what I was talking
Flushing
about.
Flushing, therefore.
They're just as obsessed with tennis as I am. But in case you're not, that's okay, too. This is a very accessible way to just find out what's happening. We'll talk to interesting guests. We don't have them all lined up yet, but I promise you they'll be phenomenal. And we're going to do a few episodes early and then late in the tournament. We'll talk about what's happening there, and then we'll also give a little color about things like how tennis players' data is collected and how they think about that. And also some non-data things, like all the fun, crazy things that happen when all the best tennis players in the world get together to, you know, see who's the best.
Excellent. And so it's called Baseline.
Yep.
And it will be in the Hot Takedown feed, however regularly it comes out. So listeners, keep an eye out for it, and be sure to send your feedback when you do hear it to podcasts@538.com. Thanks, Carl. Looking forward to it. One last thing, a word from one of our sponsors. Hot Takedown this week is sponsored by DraftKings.com. You're about to hear a lot about football stats and metrics. And football stats and metrics, you know, they're fun for the bar. They're fun to chat about with friends. They're also fun to use for fantasy football domination if you're into that kind of thing. One place to do that is DraftKings.com. DraftKings has a $1 million top prize, and that $1 million is just part of the $5 million in total prizes they are doling out in their week one contest. So DraftKings.com is the destination for 1 week fantasy football. 1 week fantasy means no season-long commitments. You play whenever you want with the players you want. All you have to do is pick your contest, draft your players, and you can follow your fantasy team live as the games take place. You can do that against friends, family, coworkers, whatever, in private groups, or against all those people and strangers and other fantasy players from across the country in open leagues as well. So hurry to DraftKings.com now to choose your players. When you're there, Use code TAKEDOWN and play for free with your first deposit. That's code TAKEDOWN to play free for your share of that $5 million in total prizes in DraftKings Week 1 contest. Only at DraftKings.com. Eligibility restrictions may apply. See the website for details, and don't forget to use code TAKEDOWN. Okay, now let's hear our first stat school. It's about passing statistics in the NFL. It was first recorded in October of 2015. Neil of 2015, take it away.
So the first stat that we're going to talk about is a very simple one, and one that is kind of natural to use for quarterbacks, certainly because they assume a lot of the responsibility for any team, especially when we're talking about media narratives about teams. And perhaps this also harkens back to the stat school we did about baseball pitching stats, and the fact that pitchers were assigned wins and losses, because this is also the concept of giving quarterbacks wins and losses, and I suppose ties, because those are possible in the NFL, that, you know, what's Drew Brees' record, what's Tom Brady's record? That's something that sort of gets thrown around.
You have to win games in the NFL to be a winner.
That's right.
You cannot lose the games
and still have a winning
statistic. Yeah. Yeah, you cannot do that.
Okay, so quarterback win percentage. Kate, does this sound like a simple stat, too simple of a stat to you?
I mean, too simple?
Like if I told you that someone had a winning percentage of 600, right, in their quarterback career, would you think that the quarterback was good automatically? Or would you say, wait, maybe there's some other stuff going on?
I think at one point in time I would have thought that. Where, like, growing up, like, 10, 12 years old, I definitely thought there was a complete direct correlation between quarterback performance and winning, especially as someone who grew up watching Phil Sims. Who probably had a pretty high winning percentage at the end of the day.
Not a high commentating percentage, though.
Right, but it kind of goes back to something, a thread through a lot of our podcasts, is how incredibly difficult it is to influence a football game as a single football player. And so as I've come to grasp that more and more, I'm obviously also disassociating a player and their actual talent and perhaps ability at the NFL level with their win-loss record.
Yeah, and one of the kind of things that I think caused people to latch on to wins and losses in the first place is when you look at the winningest quarterbacks, it actually does kind of make sense. Like, it seems like it's not that bad of a stat, because
Aaron Rodgers, Tom
you got
Brady,
Aaron Rodgers, you got Peyton Manning, you got Tom Brady, you got Russell Wilson. So it does pass the smell test, and I think that's something.
It's an interesting point. You don't really, I can't really think of a great quarterback stuck on a bad team, and that's partly because great quarterbacks make so many other people better around them, but also teams tend to shape themselves to a good quarterback and make your run with free agents, and free agents want to come play with good quarterbacks.
And also I wonder, like, obviously there's a problem, like, at CEO and company levels, where perhaps there's people who could become great CEOs, but there's so few CEO positions, and people who get there don't leave the CEO position, that sometimes I'm like, there are probably, like, thousands of great, perhaps, heads of companies who never got the opportunity. Neil, I guess my question for that is, like, do you think there have been quarterbacks who would have been amazing quarterbacks and just never got the chance to leave the backup role?
Well, certainly that seems possible. We've even seen quarterbacks like
stat,
Kurt
Neil.
Warner and you know, various others over the years sort of take over. Tom Brady himself, yeah, is maybe the archetypical example of this, where a guy wasn't thought of very highly and then by some freak injury to the starter was given a chance and ran with it. But I think we've seen the cases in which that is true are vastly outnumbered by the cases where, you know, the backup does come in and the team is really, you know, not as good and doesn't make the most of that opportunity. But and also to go to your point, Chad, about, like, it's hard to think of a great quarterback that doesn't have a great winning percentage. I think that says a lot about how we define a great quarterback. Is it, I think, more that it's chicken and egg, right? Like, do we consider someone to be a great quarterback if they don't have a good winning percentage? And I think for the majority of football history, certainly in the media and the narratives that get built there, I don't think that's true. Like, you have to be a winner to be a great quarterback, and you be a winner by winning, and then that makes you a great quarterback.
But you also have to be a winning quarterback to keep quarterbacking your team to then stack up the years to be considered in the pantheon of the greats, because, I mean, if you're posting 7-9 records continuously, the team is not going to continue shaping around their current roster. They're going to want to redo things.
So, and I understand that this is the simplest of the metrics that you're going to talk to us about, Neil, but it seems like it's not a wholly tainted one. Like, I do want a good quarterback to be a winner. Like, I don't think that's unreasonable, a request as a fan or even a stat-savvy fan, that good quarterbacks should be winners, I think.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's why the leaders in it are kind of considered the best quarterbacks, on top of this chicken and egg thing, is that playing quarterback well is associated pretty strongly with winning football games for your team. I think the issue is just that there are statistics out there that are better at isolating the quarterback himself and filtering out the contributions of his teammates and perhaps the non-contributions in the case of quarterbacks that aren't winning.
And presumably also ranking the best themselves from one another, right? Numbers 1 through 5, maybe they all have a winning percentage between 630 and 650 or higher, maybe.
Yeah, Peyton Manning has a 79% percent winning percentage just over the last four full seasons. And then Aaron Rodgers has 77%, Tom Brady 77%.
Right. And
so they're very close.
So part of what we're trying to settle with this stat school is like how to best evaluate greatness in general, as we often talk about on the show. So let's talk about Drew Brees, who I think you wanted us to use as our Sherpa Mule guide. We never know what to call these nice people who let us pin a podcast onto their careers.
Our example.
Yeah.
Right.
People so boring, Kate.
I know. Yeah. I don't want to offend anybody, though.
Yeah, someday we'll come up with an appropriate...
Our Tibetan listeners got very upset with us about using Sherpa as the people that we were...
We have a huge following.
Porters.
Tibet.
What about a porter?
Yeah. Sure.
Someone who's bringing us from place A to place B?
Okay.
Right?
Usher.
Usher. And then we could get Usher to sponsor a stat school. Usher's new album,
the artist, Usher.
I didn't know
if you had made like
big
a new
takedown list.
The wheels are really turning.
I'm sharp today, guys. Okay, this, Neil, Drew Brees, 4 years. What do you got for me in winning percentage?
Yeah, so as part of the preparation for this, I just wanted to find an example of a quarterback that sort of went against this trend of the best quarterbacks must have great winning percentages. And Drew Brees is a really good example from 2011 through 2014. So the four seasons that led up to this current season that we're in right now, he had a winning percentage of only 59.4, which is about 9.5 wins per season.
Good.
Yeah,
get him out of there.
Far below some of the other people that we mentioned, like Peyton Manning. And so it creates this conundrum because Drew Brees statistically, and we'll talk about this a little bit more, the ways that they can measure that, is even to the eye test, I guess, even, is a great quarterback. So the wins don't agree with that, and then you have to think, oh, well, why is that true? Is it because he, which is more likely, is it because he actually isn't a great quarterback, he's just kind of a mediocre guy, or is it because the winning percentage isn't capturing everything we want it to, and statisticians have, as they generally do, come down on the side of the ladder and say, well, there are better ways that we can measure and isolate the individual from his team.
A bad defense, a bad running game, whatever else might taint a quarterback's winning percentage. Okay, so, Kate, do you feel like you're ready for lesson two?
I am.
I feel
good. The winning percentage was pretty easy, I feel like, to kind of make it through.
It.
Yeah.
Thanks to your eloquent teaching.
That's for the tight end episode. Okay, so... Neil, certificates handed out. You feel good about your students' progress.
Will you sign mine though first before we move on?
Oh sure, yeah. Let me pull out my pen right now.
Neil, you've been practicing that Statman signature.
That's right.
I like that.
It's very elaborate.
Yeah. Let's move on to segment two, class two, lesson two. Neil, what is even more advanced from quarterback winning percentage, but not quite as advanced as possible?
Yeah, I mean this one. I don't know that I would necessarily feel comfortable calling it advanced, but it certainly is more advanced than winning percentage.
So novice, intermediate.
Well, what if I consider it advanced?
Yeah.
What does that mean? How should I feel?
You're supposed to be an equal opportunity teacher, Neil,
yeah.
Not shaming
right.
your students.
I don't
want to
shame the students. And particularly if you look at the formula, this is a stat that's sort of notorious for people make fun of it as an example of the impenetrability of stats in general in sports is because this formula is just weird. And I'm talking about passer rating, the NFL's passer rating
this
formula.
This is QBR.
No, this is quarterback rating. That's different than QBR. And that, for maximal confusion, things have been named similarly. But the history of this stat, it goes back to 1971. They used to rank quarterbacks by, I think, raw yardage. So they would say, oh, the passing crown, whatever that even means, in the league should go to the quarterback who had the most yards. And I think people were saying, like, well, that's kind of dumb. You know, there's touchdowns, there's completion percentage. People were passing more. But the AFL was a league that eventually would merge with the NFL. By that point, it had that passing was more a part of the game than it was in the NFL, and it really, you know, the game was opening up, and so they wanted a better metric of
and fantasy measuring. Points didn't exist yet.
Fantasy points would not exist for another more than a decade, but they wanted a statistical measure. So Pete Rozelle, who was the commissioner of football, he asked some guys, one of whom runs the Elias Sports Bureau, who you still hear about, you know, checking stats and providing facts for these leagues, to come up with a formula that would better rate passers. And so they came up with this passer rating formula that takes into account completion percentage, which is just, you know, as a percentage of your passes attempted, how many did you complete to the receiver? And, you know, reasonable to include that, I think. Yards per attempt, which is the average, you know, yardage progressed down the field when you attempt to pass by your team. The percentage of your attempts that are touchdowns, and those three are positive categories. Mm-hmm. It's better to be higher in those. And then the negative category is interceptions as a percentage of your attempts, where, you know, it's better to throw fewer interceptions. This is all very intuitive. They plug it into a very convoluted formula, and it spits out a grade that theoretically, and I think it was true when they first started because they looked at stats from the 60s through 1971, gives you sort of like a 0 to 100 scale, but most people would be between like 60 something and 100. So it's a little like the Madden ratings that we talked about.
Aren't quarterbacks sometimes they get a quarterback rating out of 160?
So the perfect quarterback rating is, I think, 158.3. Okay. And so it's possible to go over 100, and this is something that we would also, as we see the progression of passing in the league go way beyond what anyone imagined it would be in 1971, you're starting to see Aaron Rodgers have a career rating of like 105 or higher. So, but at the time, it seemed reasonable. They had this metric. They kind of came up with the weights for each category in a just like they arbitrarily decided that completion percentage should be worth this much and touchdown percentage should be worth this much. And then they plugged it into this statistical stew and kind of spat out a number to rank quarterbacks.
Yeah, I guess the part I'm wondering about is why they arbitrarily weighted which statistical category was more valuable, because our frame of reference now is like fantasy points, and to some degree, and like a touchdown would be way more valuable than just an individual completion. I mean, do you, as the stat man, you know, as the processor of all these things, do you think that they've weighted them appropriately?
They haven't, and that's something that people would kind of later, especially in the 80s, we had talked about sabermetrics with baseball. There's actually a sabermetrics of football related to the Pro Football Researchers Association of America. They had a newsletter in which guys would publish, and there's also something called The Hidden Game of Football, which is by Pete Palmer and John Thorne. They kind of poked holes in this thing, and they were like, they asked the same question as you, Kate. They said, are these weights at all like appropriate, or do they make sense in comparison to how much these stats actually help you win football games? And that was, I think, when the statistical community, such as it existed at the time, started to sort of move away from passer rating, and it kind of became, right now I think it's kind of a punchline. It's considered kind of a joke stat because the proportions were way off. First of all, including yards per attempt and completion percentage sort of double counts completion percentage, and that's something that they
slow down there. So yards
about.
Per attempt is how many, so the passes, but to get a yard, it would have to be caught.
It has to be completed in
so
the first
place.
That's
where the double.
Right,
the
if you think
up.
About it, yards per completion, which is the number when you complete a pass, conditional on completing the pass, how long did it go, times completion percentage is equal to yards per attempt, right?
Yes.
So you actually have two things in that formula that both include
that's not good for a
completion
formula.
Percentage.
What a joke of a formula. I could have made a better formula than this.
I think you may,
after this lesson,
may
I
could have, Chad, for sure. And that was just kind of one of the things that people took issue with. Like it overweights completion percentage for sure. I think it overweights touchdowns and doesn't give enough weight to the damage that interceptions do. And ultimately, it's also just like really arbitrary, and it's fixed to a scale. Like I had said earlier, they came up with this formula by looking at like the 60s and saying, what were passing conditions like? Well, let's map it so that the average performance results in like a 70 or something like that.
We're obviously going in ascending, but do you think there's any validity to saying actually we could rank quarterbacks on wins losses and be more accurate and like historically about who is better and worse versus looking at passer rating?
So that's kind of the frustrating thing about passer rating is that it's better than wins and losses because it does isolate the quarterback's stats himself. And it does, when you look at it, it correlates in a vacuum well enough to wins and losses that you would say, you know, knowing a passer rating, especially at the team level, is better than just straight up looking at, you know, wins and losses for the quarterback. But I think the frustration from the statistical community was just coming from like,
and how angry were they, do you think?
Oh, they were breaking their pocket protectors over their knees, like right.
So it was serious.
Yeah, it was so serious back then.
Okay, so what's interesting here to me is that these are all the building blocks of a quarterback's success, some double counted, whatever else. But still, this isn't good enough, right? But there's a way to create something that's more accurate and is not accurate at all whenever doing any stats, I guess, right? That like any type of metric or model that you create, just because it's approaching some better ideal doesn't mean that it's even close to the ideal in the first place. And that the other ones are a little better, but we're going to talk about it later, so I should stop asking questions about it.
Yeah, there have been a bunch of attempts to try to make it better. And one of the ways was just, like you alluded to, Kate, changing the weighting and just kind of figuring out, like, okay, how let's actually sit down and work out how much is a yard of passing worth and how much is a touchdown worth. You know, obviously it's worth a certain amount on the scoreboard, but trying to isolate, like, in the context of an offense, if you know, like, a yard is your measuring stick, how much marginal, because touchdowns do include yards also, like you had to have gained the last yard to cross the goal line, then also how much marginal value is there to that act of scoring the touchdown, and how much of a penalty should an interception cost you in terms of actual field position, because that's kind of what things, all of these things should be ideally measuring. If you're going to have a yard of field position moving toward the goal that you're trying to score at, then you should also say an interception actually cost you 45 yards of field position, and that's what Palmer and Thorne eventually found in this very influential book, The Hidden Game of Football. They're like, let's actually break this down logically and figure out what the equivalences are in yardage, and that was an improvement off the bat.
Let's talk about Drew Brees again. Is he more in line with our thinking about Drew Brees in passer rating than he was with win percentage?
Oh, for sure. Yeah, Drew Brees, over the years that we were looking at, his passer or his win-loss percentage, like we said, 59%. That's like maybe above average, but like pretty mediocre as far as these things go. But his passer rating was 102.1, which...
That's Aaron Rodgers' level.
Mm-hmm. Sort of. I should say that Aaron Rodgers was at 112.6, which also goes back to what we were saying about the problems with passer rating, is that it is scaled against what was good and bad in 1968 or 70 or whatever. And the passing game really exploded starting in 1978, where they loosened restrictions on defenders to be able to touch receivers and things like that. And really has just gone ever more toward, you know, crazy numbers in the years since, especially in recent years. And so what used to be considered a really good passer rating is now, you know, like if you were in the 90s as a passer, you were considered to be like one of the best quarterbacks in football as recently as like the 1990s. But then now, if you're in the 90s, you have to be there just to kind of keep up and be above average. The league average is in the mid to high 80s right now, which is not at all what it was in the
60s. Patrick is in this league.
Yeah, that's great.
So I feel good about passer rating. I'm still a little...
I have one more question.
Yeah, go ahead.
Sure.
If you use like a car metaphor, did the folks who developed this particular vehicle in the 60s and 70s, did they do the best they could with what they had at that time? Or was that a clunker?
No, I think it was the best they could do with what they have, because like computing was not really much of a thing back then. Like all of these things that we take for granted now, that I can run a regression and figure out the equivalencies of yardage yardage to, you know, touchdowns and interceptions on my computer this afternoon if I wanted to. They would have to go into a room where the computer was like the size of the whole room and kind of plug in punch cards. So I think it absolutely was the best they could do, but that doesn't mean that we can't improve on it as technology gets
absolutely
better.
And the inertia of sports just kept it going. Okay, I think I got like a C+, B-. Mm-hmm. I'm going to grade myself on that segment.
Really?
How are you feeling about your progress, Kate?
It depends what questions Professor Payne would ask.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. Is it an open book test? Is it an essay?
If it was an essay, I think I would blow it away. Okay. Like I comprehend it, but I couldn't write out the equation for it. Right.
But in the abstract way, you get
I feel like I'm an A-.
Yeah, it's going to be an open note exam. So I hope you guys were furiously scribbling down.
You saw us take those notes.
Yeah, I have this recorded, so I'll just listen back to it.
That's what podcasts are for. Okay, so I like that you record our own podcast in a private.
Double, just in case something fails on the technology end.
Got to be prepared.
Yep.
Neil, third lesson, final lesson, the pinnacle of quarterback stats, at least that you think that we can comprehend. I'm sure there's a whole extra galaxy out there that you're not willing to take us to. What is more complicated than winning percentage, more complicated than passer rating, and presumably more accurate than both?
And still comprehensible for like an average human mind.
Right. So the third stat is called expected points. And I'm going to go back to Palmer and Thorne because their book was just so influential on football statistics. In their book, in addition to coming up with like a better passer rating using the conventional box score stats, they posited and they couldn't actually compute it at the time because, again, they didn't have like the database technology and certainly didn't have the types of computing power that we have now. They posited this idea of, well, why don't we track, like, we know based on like down and distance and current field position how many points you can expect to score before the other team scores again. And
so, okay, so let's take an example. Right. So Kate and I are the Hot Takedowners, the Hot Downers.
Walt's our quarterback,
exactly.
Bad news already.
We're lining up in an I formation. Mm-hmm. We're on the opponent's 23-yard line, and it's first and 10, I guess, right? And you're telling me that you could say how many points we're supposed to score given all teams or given us?
We're 23 yards away.
Right, yes, exactly.
So you're on your own 23?
No, we're 23 yards from
you're on the opponent's 23.
I mean, that's worth at least 4 expected points, right?
Right.
You figure you definitely get
definitely
the field goal
and maybe a 30% chance we're going to score. I don't know, I'm just making these things up.
Neil,
but you taught us well.
Neil is furiously typing these arbitrary numbers into an online calculator to see whether or not...
We're stretching out the time we're talking.
We're vamping, right?
Yeah, we're really vamping right now.
As Neil processes this.
So this situation, first and 10, from the opponent's 23.
Yeah, did you say that Walt is our quarterback? Does that matter?
I could try to build that in by making the Vegas line be like you're expected to lose by 50 points or something like that. But if you are in sort of an average situation, it's the first quarter, the ball's at the opponent's 23, it's first and 10, your expected points, you said this, Chad, I think it's almost exactly 4.
What about what I said?
I graduate immediately.
I said there's like a 30% chance we get the touchdown.
So I don't have that number right now.
Well, wait, wouldn't it be 25% basically? Or no, because the field goal's not a gimme and there could be interceptions. Yeah, yeah. Got it. All right. Yeah. Sorry.
But an expected points of 4, that means that based on your situation, you're either going to score a touchdown, there's like a good shot that you'll score, or your field position is so advantageous for your defense if they were to get the ball back, even if you turned it over on downs, you would likely get the ball after the offense, the opposing offense did their thing, you would get it back in a pretty good position too, and then all of this would eventually kind of compound on itself until you scored a touchdown.
And that's because yardage is really the unit of football rather than points.
That's right. Yeah, and that was something that Palmer and Thorne really figured out, was that field position is fluid, and it does depend, like, you're have these competing objectives of you're trying to gain as much yardage as possible, but you're trying to gain it in these 10-yard chunks before your downs run out, but that you can compute, if you smooth out a lot of different things, the expected points, and then the value of any given play, especially from the quarterback's perspective, like a pass completed down the field, is equal to the expected points that you will score after that play is concluded minus the expected points that you had going into that play.
So simply put, like a quarterback who doesn't throw interceptions in the red zone is going to have a better total in this particular statistic than a quarterback who does.
Yeah, because there's like
a, there's a lot of expected points on the line.
Right. There's like a leverage aspect, and we talked about leverage index in baseball, which just means that, like, yeah, when you're in a situation down near the opponent's goal line, it is really important to capitalize on that, and those are sort of more high leverage. And also the down can also make it high leverage, because the difference between picking up the yards necessary on third down versus, you know, having to punt on fourth is really big compared to what the same yardage situation would be on between first and second. And that's also baked in. Like, this is an improvement over the raw numbers that you saw go into passer rating, because, like, if your quarterback is consistently, and a friend of mine is a huge Buffalo Bills fan, and we watch the game pretty much every week, Tyrod Taylor was making a lot of throws, I guess at this point it'll be 2 weeks ago for the listener, that were short of, like, the pass was completed on third down, but it was short of the sticks. And those completions in the stat sheet, if it's like, you know, third and 10 and you complete a nine-yard pass in like a neutral context situation is pretty good. Like, you know, that's what
it's
you would
well
hope
above the
to,
league average of yards
right,
per
yeah, the league yards per attempt is something in this high sevens or eight. So you're doing better than average. But if you put in this context of like, how is it actually helping your team score based on the rules of football and the down and distance, it's actually kind of bad. It's below average because you didn't pick up the first down. You didn't even target the ball past the marks, mm-hmm.
so
the markers.
I have two more questions. One, this is compared to league average that year or the NFL's historic average? Like, so expected point added, where is the expectation coming from?
Yeah, so you can do it in a number of ways, and I think some of the more advanced ones try to kind of project it forward and figure out, like, in the context of this year, based on the scoring environment mm-hmm. and all of the various other things, what is a yard worth? But you could just, like, build a very good expected points model by just taking the last, like, 5 years worth of play-by-play and then trying to map, you know, every down and distance and yardage situation to how much was scored over the past 5 years.
Okay, and so the average expected points added, is it zero because of there's expectation involved?
It's not zero, interestingly enough, for quarterbacks. Like, if you looked at every quarterback in the league and added up their expected points, it would be positive, which is kind of weird because you would think, oh, well, that's why does wouldn't we expect it to always be centered around zero and that there would be good passers that help their teams and some that don't? And one of the implications of this is that passing is a better proposition in terms of helping teams score than running the ball is. And in fact, running the ball has its own, like, a lot of times you will intentionally give away expected points on rushing plays in order to milk the clock and get win probability added. And that may be for another podcast, but that's the concept of win probability added is just taking the same idea as expected points added and saying, like, what's the difference between the play at the end of it and the play at the beginning? And instead of measuring the difference in this expected point stat, measuring it in win probability, which is what are your odds of winning, taking into account all of the things that expected points has, so like field position, down and distance, but also adding in what is the score and how much time is left in the game.
This is something as a Giants fan I know well.
Yeah.
from week one. And also from, like, it seems, I don't know, maybe it's just because I'm paying attention to them, but they seem to always put themselves in these predicaments, like at the end of the Super Bowl against the Patriots in 2011, where they almost, like, didn't want to score a touchdown. You're in that weird,
when,
like,
Bradshaw fell over backwards on his butt.
He tried to
half-heartedly.
He couldn't, and then he sort of stumbled in. Right. Like, there's that whole, it's almost like, you know, like the clutch and gas on a car where you're trying to, for that perfect balance of time.
So many car metaphors today, Kate.
I know.
You really love the car metaphors, Kate.
I don't know why. I did lease a car a couple months ago. Maybe it's just playing on my mind.
Could be.
But, I mean, you're kind of playing, right, on that, like, do I want more win probability, less time off the clock, leave points on the table?
Yeah, exactly. And so in a lot of rushing plays, you're deliberately leaving points on the table. And so since overall, across all offensive plays, so passes and rushes and, you know, fumbles that happen when the ball snapped over the punter's head, those all average out to zero expected points across the whole league. But when looking at passes as a subset, it kind of means that teams are not passing enough still. Like, we still haven't reached that equilibrium where it would be better to kind of, you know, when everyone else is passing, to run the ball. But also it does speak to this phenomenon of the clock and the clock's, you know, not stopping when you run the ball, so you need to milk it at the end of games.
I guess, do you think that, is there any way to bake into stats needing to convince the defense that you can do things other than pass? passing.
That's
right?
Another interesting thought.
I think a lot of teams run is to be like, we're not always passing. Gotta, you know, gotta be honest on our run.
Right. Yeah. I think I think that's another part of why you see this, like, if you looked at it strictly from an expected points standpoint,
pass every time.
You'd be like, gosh, we're not passing enough. We need to do more. So that's why it's so tough to say, like, what the optimal run-pass balance is in the league, because it is a game theory question. And it's a question of, like, trying to find what's called, like, the Nash equilibrium, where you're doing the optimal thing from your perspective and the defense is doing the optimal thing from its perspective and no one can kind of improve. And it's tough to say whether we've reached that or not. It's really tough to measure that.
Well, is it tough to say if Chip Kelly has mastered it yet?
I think he may be the toughest of all to tell.
Okay, so quickly, let's talk about our guide mule, Sherpa Porter.
Example. Usher.
for expected points added. We're going to move on from Drew Brees. Is that right, Neil?
Yeah, so we couldn't let Drew Brees kind of carry the load all by himself, so we wanted to bring in another quarterback that kind of typifies this difference that talks about, like, passer rating in and of itself, huge improvement over winning percentage, but it can also be improved by fixing the formula and also by just looking at these expected points instead of using the traditional box score, yards, touchdowns, interceptions, that kind of thing. So we're going to bring in Cam Newton as our example of a guy who, just by looking at his passer rating, you might think, oh, this guy really isn't so hot. You know, he had an 85 passer rating over the preceding four seasons, and that is right around league average, actually. He, like, a shade over league average. So you'd think Cam Newton, you know, he's an all right passer. But one of the things passer rating also notoriously doesn't take into account is rushing. And so, you know, Cam Newton could get credit for that. And he could get credit for just doing little things that, like, keep the offense on schedule, even if it's not being captured in his conventional box score stats. And if you look at his expected points, he's actually one of the best quarterbacks in the league. And you mentioned QBR, which is ESPN's improvement upon quarterback rating. It, at its foundation, uses expected points as the metric that sort of
drives.
So Cam
Newton has a good QBR as well.
So Cam Newton had, yeah, like a top 11, I want to say, QBR over the span that we were looking at, even though he was kind of average among passers in quarterback
probably
rating.
Probably win-loss.
And, you know, win-loss, yeah. I mean, they're right around 500 most of the year. So, you know, it makes sense that he would show up as someone that you need to kind of add in these extra wrinkles, and especially the rushing component is big for him. And it can make the difference between, you know, looking like an average quarterback and looking like one of the, you know, arguably a top 10 quarterback based on it. So it's funny to think about how, even though passer rating is isolating individual performance much better, especially if you think back to the 70s, the best they could do pretty much, compared to something really dumb and really, like, broad based, like wins and losses, that you can improve on it enough to make an average quarterback look really good, or vice versa, by using something even more like play-by-play based rather than box score based.
And that was our stat school about passing metrics in the NFL. One more still to come about rushing metrics. But first, a word from one of Hot Takedown's sponsors. The other Hot Takedown sponsor this week, it's Stamps.com. These days, you can get practically everything on demand, like this podcast that you're listening to. You can listen to it whenever you want, when it's convenient for you. Stamps.com wants to make the same thing happen, but for postage. So why are you still making time-consuming trips to the post office when you can get postage on demand with Stamps.com? Anything you can do at the post office, you can now do right from your desk with Stamps.com. Buy and print official U.S. postage for any letter or package using your own computer and printer. And unlike the post office, Stamps.com never closes, so you can get postage whenever you need it, including at 3 a.m. when you forgot to send your grandmother her birthday card. Plus, you'll even get special postage discounts with Stamps.com that you can't find at the post office. Right now, sign up for Stamps.com and use the promo code ESPN to get this special offer, a 4-week trial plus a $110 bonus offer that includes postage and a digital scale. So don't wait. Go to Stamps.com, and before you do anything else, click on the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in ESPN. That's Stamps.com, and be sure to enter the promo code ESPN.
And now, at long last, to complete our duet of stat schools, it's one on rushing metrics in the NFL. This one was recorded in November of 2015, so you'll hear our voices just a little more grizzled than they were before. And as before, Neil, the stat man Payne, take it away.
So the kind of base level rushing analysis that people do, or at least did in the past for sure, was just looking at like raw yardage and touchdowns.
I've heard of those.
Yes.
Have you, Kate?
I have. Yeah. Running backs and then the yards.
So they like they run for the yards, I think.
And then at the end you're like, how many did they run? And then they tell you.
That's a great stat.
Yeah.
Sure. Is it not a great stat?
It says it all.
So I think there are some things wrong with it. Like we've learned a lot in stat school of just like purely counting things is sort of like the first step, but then, you know, not going beyond that step, you can kind of lose a lot of the nuance that makes certain players or teams good or bad. And one of the things that they learned with just the raw rushing totals is, you know, it's important to take into account opportunity, and especially with touchdowns, very much important to take into account opportunity, because we've all, I think, this discussion, because we're talking about running backs, it's going to go to fantasy football, I think, in some ways. And we've all known the agony of having that running back on our fantasy team that, you know, leads, marches the team down the field and picks up a majority of the yards as the team is kind of approaching the goal line. And then they bring in, say, like Mike Allstott or someone like that.
Is this getting personal
some fullback
for you?
You know, there's some things.
I was going to say, why we all know the feeling. I think you meant to say, I know the feeling.
Desperately know the feeling.
Right. And so they'll bring in, and teams, you know, especially now that they have running backs by committee, you don't see the split being so pronounced between like the goal line runners and the all purpose midfield runners. But, you know, there would be running back platoons as recently as 10, 15 years ago where the smaller the running backs, the more kind of outside runner would take. Gobble up all the yards, and then they would bring in someone who was more of a between the tackles runner to pick up the touchdowns. And so if you had the outside rusher in your on your fantasy team, touchdowns are very valuable in fantasy football, and depending on your scoring system, they still are. So that person would kind of gobble up a lot of the points, even though he didn't necessarily do the dirty work of getting the team into position to actually score the rushing touchdown.
I believe the Giants had the thunder and lightning combo.
That's right, yeah. So that's often the configuration.
It was Brandon Jacobs, or was this like Ron Dane?
Ron Dane was Thunder.
It was way back in the day.
Ron Dane was Thunder.
Was it Tiki
and
as lightning?
Tiki was lightning, I think.
Although
it was
Brandon
in
Jacobs
Tiki's later years.
Was also, they also kind of overlapped.
Ahmad Bradshaw, right?
They were like 2.0.
It was
the
another storm.
Do this a lot, I think.
That's the moral of it, that they do it a lot. But I remember this. I remember exactly what you're talking about happening with the football Giants.
Okay, so that seems almost self-evident to me that sometimes just straight stats can work for something like this, and sometimes they're hiding something.
But I think they're – yes, I totally agree, and I want to hear the next level of stats. But I do think sometimes as a fan or anybody in sports, we're like, okay, we're not counting opportunity, but sometimes you can have the sense like, well, why isn't a player getting more opportunity? And you kind of feel like, well, if the – player isn't getting more opportunities because the coach doesn't think they're as good. So it's almost like self-selective in my mind that if you're a back that's getting the ball a lot, that's because you earned it.
Right. And that's something that we'll talk about later, too, okay. About how that it sort of comes back to recognizing that. But also that just purely looking at the raw numbers is not necessarily the best way to do it. And we have other fancy things that we can do with the numbers.
All right,
the
numbers. I'm in.
Okay, so... do we need a Sherpa Mule guide for this section to take us into the next? Kate wants all the Sherpas we can.
I just like a protagonist.
Well, maybe Mike Allstott and Mark Dunn from the 2000.
That's what it is. Who's our protagonist?
Yeah,
that's
good. The 2000.
Finally,
Buccaneers
we answered this mystery. Okay, so who is our protagonist for the running game, Neil?
Well, so in general, we were going to talk about Adrian Peterson because he right now is a player who hasn't scored as many touchdowns as you would expect given his number of carries, but he also has a huge number of rushing yards, so it doesn't quite fit the profile of someone who, you know, he might be the person that is picking up the yards in between, you know, the goal lines, and you know, he's not closing off the drives with touchdowns as much as you would expect from that. So we'll see in the next section how, you know, if you start counting opportunities and looking things like that, he starts to look different.
Okay. I'm ready for the next course. Are you, Kate?
I have fully digested the first course, and I'm ready for the second.
Oh, we're in food metaphors now. We've moved on
to
school
metaphors.
It's a lot
of mixed metaphors, so we're just going to roll.
Absolutely. Neil, bring us our next dish.
Okay. So once people sort of started trying to dig into the analytics of the rushing game, they started thinking about, just like we saw with passing, where the idea was to move from sort of these raw, you know, yardage and touchdowns and interceptions, start to kind of compile it all together and start to average things. And so that's when you started seeing more of a focus on like yards per carry and saying, oh, well, you know, Eddie George might have a ton of raw yards, but look, he's averaging like 3.8 yards per carry. You know, he is not being as efficient with his touches as some of the other running backs in the league. And, you know, there's certainly a lot of wisdom to that, I think, just like we saw with passing, that on a per-opportunity basis, football, you know, your job is to pick up yards and your job is to move the ball down the field, but you also have to do it in these discrete chunks. You only have, you know, four downs at most and practically speaking only three really within the context of a normal offense to pick up the yards. So if you're not churning out yards with regularity, it can really short-circuit your offense and make it hard to move the ball.
The yards per carry thing brings up, I think, your point, Kay, that you just made about whether coaches are using the running backs to their as much as they should or more than they should, because if I see that a running back has 5 yards per carry but is only getting 8 carries a game because they're a third down back or something like that, then maybe they should be the every down back, right? And so, like, is this a stat, Neil, that we could look at where we're sort of seeking an equilibrium where we want someone to run? If they're running for too many yards per carry, they should probably get more carries. If they're running for too few, maybe they need to get fewer, and you end up somewhere at like 4.2 yards per carry or something like that.
Yeah, I think that sounds about right. Like, I think one of the things that we'll talk about in the next stage of all this is that also context is really important. So your third down back might be getting 5.2 yards per carry specifically because of the situations in which he's in the game and being called on to run like a bunch of draw plays and, you know, things in which he is being put, you know, given the opportunity not just to carry the ball, but in a very favorable situation to picking up yards. So that might be a flaw with yards per carry. But at the same time, if your every down back is only churning out 3.6 yards per carry, that is probably not a sign of a very healthy offense. And all of the context in the world isn't necessarily going to make that look like a really good performance, necessarily.
Right, and it's kind of like when we talked about Steph Curry and the pace he has going being out of this world, and we assume that the more opportunities we add to that, the more down-to-earth he comes. The same with yards per carry, at least at the NFL level. I feel like if I see somebody with some running back with like 6-7 yards per carry, I'm like, oh, well, he doesn't have enough carries.
Yeah.
But obviously. I think with running, though, there's fatigue that comes into it, too, in a way that maybe for Curry, because he's playing whatever it's going to be, 42 minutes a night anyway, that the fatigue doesn't – like Curry's going to regress to his own mean, whereas mm-hmm. for a running back, I think there's a possibility that they're being used – in not enough situations. And if they start to get used in more, their yards per carry might come down, and it might be because there's a situational factor, but also might be because they don't have the endurance or the stamina at this moment in their career to be able to run 20 times a game. They can only run 8 times a game. And then coaches, I think, have to figure out whether it's more worth it for them to get 6 yards per carry 8 times a game or 3.9 yards per carry 20 times a game.
Yeah, and durability is huge with running backs, I feel like. So, like, there's a reason that you see, like, Darren Sproles or someone like that never really be, like, a featured back who's running the ball, you know, like, 20-plus times per game. He's, like, super tiny, you know? Like, right. And so, you know, asking him to carry that much of a load would take down his efficiency, and it also would prevent him from being able to be used in the passing game.
Running backs, you know, in general should not carry loads while they run. That would slow them down.
No. Yeah. And we saw the same thing with Reggie Bush, too. And like, okay, we need to totally thread the needle here on when he's playing and what circumstances he's playing.
And whether he's receiving predominantly
or
not.
You know, and returning punts, if we want the best out of him. There seems to be a lot of calculation going on in a coach's head of like return for when they use somebody and how they use somebody and when that there's a tipping point there.
Yeah, and maybe the best running backs are the ones where you don't have to have all the kid gloves and be like very carefully managing, put them in like a safe situation in which they can pick up the yards. And I think Reggie Bush, when he was in college, people thought that he would be able to transition to become someone that wouldn't need all of that kind of, for lack of a better term, coddling or something like that, where like you have to manage his situations very specifically. And then once he got to the pros, you realized that he really couldn't be that every down back and that you had to manage it.
Okay, how's our protagonist doing with yards per carry?
So Adrian Peterson right now, and we should say that this might, I'm going to be vague because this is airing in the future, but it'll probably still be true. He has a very good yards per carry average by the standards of a running back who carries the ball as much as him, especially, and this sort of goes to what we were talking about, this kind of trade-off between durability and sort of how much you're used and how many yards you can put up. And that's one of the big reasons why, as of this taping right now, he's leading the league in rushing yards. And, you know, perhaps that will continue. But
is he leading in yards per carry?
He doesn't lead the league in yards per carry because there are guys like Gio Bernard and people like that who have carried the ball less than him and are averaging like your 5.6 yards per carry. But Peterson might be in like sort of the middle zone where you're getting a lot of work out of him, and he's also averaging, you know, good solid number of yards per carry.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I feel good about yards per carry.
But there's still, when we're missing a lot of nuance that we need you to inject into these.
There
stats.
Always is. Yeah, we always have to.
I feel like I trust yards per carry more than yards. Despite all the issues with situation and whatever else, that to me feels like I'd rather know if a player is good because of yards per carry than I would the number of touchdowns he scores or the number of yards total. Kate, are you with me there? Or do you still feel good about
yards? I mean, there's obviously a ton of overlap there.
Right, for sure.
But I think as someone who watching football, the thing I think most is, okay, we're giving the ball to this guy, and I generally feel like he gets this amount.
4 to 5 amount.
Right. It's kind of like when the Giants secondary for a while, every time an opposing team would pass, I would think, oh, this is not good. You have those general senses. And so the thing I usually rely on is, oh, this guy produces TK amount of yards.
And it also bears mentioning that there's this extra dynamic to rushing where teams actually, like, they win not because they run necessarily, but they get a lot of rushing yards because they're winning. And I think we'll talk about that as we take it to the next level. But this idea of having someone who can sort of run out the clock and tack on those yards late in the game in support of what the team has already done is a distinct skill and a distinct phenomenon from actually kind of going out there and quote-unquote establishing the run, which is a term that you used to hear a lot, and I don't know if you hear it as much anymore.
Ain't nobody want to establish the run anymore. They just want to throw the ball.
That's right.
All right,
throwing the ball is fun.
Take us to that next level, stat man.
Okay.
The pinnacle of rushing stats. That's another mixed metaphor, because now we're at mountain metaphors. We've gone through school metaphors.
Culinary.
Food metaphors. Mountain metaphors. This is good. This might be a record for a stat school.
Cool.
We're mixing them all over the place. So the kind of the highest level, we'll kind of refer to it as almost like the twin peaks, if you will, of the of rushing production is expected points added and win probability added. And the idea there is that like yardage isn't enough to really even measure, even if you're doing it on a per carry basis, that your goal as a football player isn't to pick up yards in, you know, it is in a certain extent, but you have to gain the 10 yards every four plays to have the right to try to pick up more yards. And so expected points tries to measure how many points are you actually adding to your team's potential to score on a given drive in a given game. And so if you pick up 5 yards on third down and 6, you're really not contributing as much to the team's, you know, your yards per carry is going to look good, but you're not contributing to the team's chances of scoring as much as if you picked that up on first and 10, because then you would set up a very manageable second and 4 and so on and so forth. So the idea that not all yards are created equal is something that this expected points algorithm, and I should say expected points is calculated by saying like, okay, what down and distance is it? Where are you on the field? Okay, this is the number of points that we expect the team to score before the other team scores. So it's like the net expected number of future points. And any change that is sort of caused by your actions on a given play, if you carried the ball 5 yards, you would calculate expected points added by looking at how many points the team is expected to score after your play and compare that to how many they were expected to score before the play.
So does this get at Kate's question about the nuances that we need you to add before that now we're seeing situation in everything? Because we sort of, I think we do, especially in football, care about the situation. I think that because a football drive, a National Football League football drive, is comprised of sort of links in a chain. And you sort of see that whenever they show those graphics,
with a straight
bold arrow if it's a run and an arcing arrow if it's a pass or whatever, right? We see that these are all connected events because of the down infrastructure that's imposed on the rules. And so it seems to me like I do really want to know about situation when I'm thinking about running.
Well, it's definitely adding situation, but it's. And maybe it is, maybe it's not. Maybe you can talk more about it. But it's not totally telling me what the teammates are doing.
Oh,
in
sure.
That. Well, I mean, which you know, of course. It's like even it's though it's not a great stat in basketball, there is kind of like the one that analyzes when you're on the floor with these people. This is the outcome, and so then when it comes to the running back, it gets to the heart of what we haven't mentioned yet in the podcast is like just the devaluing of running backs over the last 10 years and why, and obviously it would be because it seems like we believe they're plug and play. And I don't know that, I'm not saying I agree with that, but there is sort of like that belief. So then it gets at like even further if you look at the Cowboys last year and DeMarco Murray versus McFadden versus what Murray's doing in Philly, and how do we get all of that into a stat?
Right, and I think all of what you just said is why football is like super complicated to right. break down, especially for individual players. And so, you know, there's research that shows that the offensive line is almost completely responsible for how many yards you pick up in within like the first few yards of the line of scrimmage in both directions. So if you get stuffed, there's not really a whole lot you can do. But if you churn forward for like 2 yards or what have you, maybe even three, it's really more about the offensive line than the running back himself. So the skill that the running backs are bringing beyond that is their ability to sort of find holes and, you know, hit them and get it to the next level and tack on yards past that. But something that cuts against that and something that's important to talk about that is picked up by a stat like expected points added that's not picked up by something like, you know, yards per carry is just that there's a lot of spikes to a player's yards per carry. Like a guy could churn along and have like 2 yards, 2 yards, 2 yards, a three and out, and do that a bunch of times. But then he might have like one play where he hits a home run and has like 80 yards. And so his yards per carry, because of the huge variance in his actual like individual carries, how many yards they pick up, it could look pretty good, but really he, on a given play, he's more likely hurting the offense in sort of the humdrum, you know, drive to drive down, you know, first down to first down way, and he'll have like one good play. And so that's why a lot of these things like, you know, Football Outsiders has defense adjusted value over average, which is sort of a form of expected points added that they have for every player. And that stat sort of filters some of that out and tries to acknowledge that, yeah, that run that you had was really good, but at the same time, it isn't consistent. Consistency in the running game, I think, is one of the biggest findings that sort of goes to the next level beyond yards per carry. It's just that you almost want to know the average yards per carry and also like the standard deviation of the guy's yards per carry, because you want to know, can a guy consistently help you work toward that first down? That in and of itself is almost more valuable than having a few, you know, long runs to go with a bunch of just like short nothing runs.
So how's Peterson at EPA and
win probability
and WPA?
Well, we haven't talked about WPA yet, but I'll just for Peterson, he right now has the biggest differential between his like I mentioned, defense adjusted value over average at Football Outsiders, and that which you would expect from his yard per carry. So if from that, you can kind of gather that maybe some of it is the shortfall that he has on touchdowns that we mentioned earlier, but it's also situational, the importance of situation to that yards per carry, where it tells me that he's picking up yards that don't really matter toward helping the team move the ball consistently toward scoring points, that the yards are being picked up in situations where it was relatively less meaningful than the average yard in across all running backs. And we should also say that this doesn't even talk about win probability added, which I think is really important for running backs in particular and just sort of the team's running game, because of what we said earlier about how you run when you win, not the fact that you win when you run, that the running game in the second half, especially when you had the lead, is not about picking up yards. There's a certain point in the game where it becomes actually sort of your focus as a coach is not about maximizing the number of yards, even maximizing your chances toward a first down, as much as it is about just getting a decent chunk of yards, but also milking the clock. And being able to run down the clock is something that WPA picks up, where it actually tracks the impact not just of how much you move the ball, but also how many seconds ticked off the clock and how much you're kind of taking away from the other team's chances of winning every time you pick up that kind of decently sized gain late in a game that sort of helps move the ball, but maybe early in the game you would have liked to have moved it even further.
And I'd ask you how Peterson is doing those stats, but these stats are hard to come by, partly because of how complex they are and how many models that need to happen in order for these stats to be calculated.
Right, and hopefully at some point our friends, our employers at ESPN will be able to kind of add the work of Brian Burke, who joined the team and was sort of the guru of all things win probability added when he had his own site. So we're excited about seeing all the cool things that he can do now that he's a member of the team here at ESPN.
All right, so, Kate, we've learned three things. How do you feel about those three things? Do you feel like it's changed the way that you watch football on Sundays when you see a man
that is a
carry
lofty
a pigskin?
Goal.
That's what Statman aspires to, right, Statman? That you want to change the minds of the youth whom you educate.
I mean, that's a little extreme, Chad.
That's what I try and do every time we sit down for hot takes.
Every time I talk to anyone, that's really my goal. It's just completely, radically
I've felt that
their life.
When I've spoken to you.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like I... The round edges have been finely tuned by Neil here about running backs. I mean, I think...
See, that's what I'm aiming for.
The takeaway, of course, is like in baseball, I'm like, oh my God, I don't get, I don't even get this stuff. I need you to break it apart. Like, the takeaway is like football's really, really hard to have stats that really, really tell you more and a lot more than you can just gather by observing and looking at all the rudimentary ones that we already have access to.
And maybe the good thing about the running back stat school and like the fact that it is so complex in the running game, even compared to, say, the passing game, is that at the end of the day, in the NFL especially, passing is just like way more important than running. So in a certain sense, I mean, this is why you see the range of quarterback values in a stat like QBR and expected points from that, and then also Football Outsiders metrics, is so much wider than it is for running backs, that like the best running back in a given season only contributes a fraction of what the best quarterback contributes. And that's just because you win by and large in the NFL by how well you pass the ball and stop the pass, and not necessarily how well you run the ball and stop the run. It's sad for all those running backs who are putting themselves in line and hurtling themselves against the brick wall of the defense, but it seems to be the case right now the way the game is played.
So that will do it for this week's show. That's a double edition of our old Stat School segments on the NFL. It is amazing how much I had forgotten. Usually I thank my co-hosts, but they're not here. So I'm going to instead go straight to Joe Sykes, our podcast producer. Our podcast overlord is Jody Avergan. We got production assistance today from Jorge Estrada. You can email us at podcast@538.com. Let us know what you think. Should we do more of these compilation episodes? We're thinking about it. We are on your favorite podcast app as well as iTunes. You can subscribe to this podcast at itunes.com/538. If this is the first time that you're hearing, if this is not the first time that you're hearing it, leave a review, leave a rating. It helps others find the show so it can be their first time hearing it. Our theme song is by Mystery Mansion.
I'm Chadwick Matlin. Talk to you next time.